Welcome to the Well Studying Podcast. This is episode 56. It's December 13th, 2014. I'm your host, John Pugliano. I'm also the founder and money manager of InvestableWealth.com. Money may not buy happiness, but it can buy freedom, and that's what we try and talk about in every episode of the Well Studying Podcast, where I teach you one or more of the 10 wealth-building principles. If you're new to the show and you're not familiar with those principles, go back and listen to the first 10 episodes. That's where I lay out the foundation that's helped me not only build my wealth, but more importantly, helped me attain personal freedom. In today's episode, I'm going to talk a little bit about exchange-traded funds and why they may be the best option for you. I've received a lot of questions about ETFs, mutual funds, so I'm going to talk a little bit about these different investment vehicles or asset classes, things like stocks and bonds, and then we'll finish up specifically on exchange-traded funds, why that could be a good option for you. Most people intuitively know that it's a better way to go, but I'm going to tell you why they're so effective and so efficient. Hey, I also want to welcome everybody back, especially those of you that might be new listeners. I'm amazed and grateful every day as I see new subscribers come in and more feedback. So I appreciate all your support, especially those of you that have made the effort to go out and subscribe in iTunes or Stitcher or whatever source you use. And those of you that have written reviews, thank you. That really, really helps build the audience. So hey, let's talk about some different ways that you have to invest your money. And so what we're going to talk about will be cash, bonds, stocks, mutual funds, and then exchange-traded funds, ETFs. Now, some of you may be surprised that I put cash in there, but I want you to know that going to a cash position is definitely an asset class, and it's something you should always consider. In many cases, it may be your best investment vehicle. If you've listened to the 10 wealth-building principles, you know that I talk about three steps of wealth. First, you have to be an earner, right? You have to earn an income, and then you have to be a saver. You have to work more on saving than you do on consuming. So then once you've built up a nest egg, you have some critical mass, and then you can put that money to work for you. That's where you get to the point where you build investment income. Those are the three steps: earn, save, invest. Your money can't go to work for you if you don't have any money. Now, the financial industry, everybody wants to sell you products, and so they try and convince you you're an investor even when you aren't. Many of you, you should just be in cash. You should be putting that money away, saving it someplace where it's safe. When it gets big enough, then you can really start investing it and spending time on that. What's that number? It's really different for everybody, so it's hard for me to say. It's one of those depends answers. And we'll talk more about that in other episodes. And you can also go back and hear what I've already said in previous episodes, particularly some of those 10 wealth-building principles. So today I'm not going to specifically focus on what your cash balances should be, things like that, if you're making that transition from being a saver to an investor. But I do want to state, you know, specifically for the investors, cash is not a bad position to be in right now. The vast majority of the client money that I manage is in cash. I would venture to say, 99% of it. I haven't looked at the number as today's Saturday. I haven't cleared my books to actually look at the number, but we're very much in cash. As far as my own personal position, I would say probably at least 90%, if not more, of my own personal money is in cash. And when I say cash, I don't mean, $20 and $50 bills in my wallet or even in a bank account somewhere. I'm talking about money that I invest for clients that would be at a brokerage account. And what we've done is we've sold our equity positions. We've sold our stocks and we've moved that into a money market fund. Now it's still within the account. We never took it out of the account. So if the account happened to be a tax advantaged account like a Roth IRA or a traditional IRA, well, we're in a cash position in a money market fund that's still within that Roth IRA. So it's tax advantaged, right? They're not going to have to pay taxes on it. We sold the positions because we felt they were at risk. If you've been listening along, you know that we had a lot of volatility this week in the stock market. That volatility has put the uptrend that we've been in for the last 7 weeks or so, it's put it under pressure. So for the most part, on Friday, I closed out all my positions. So that's why I talk about being in cash. Cash is an investment option. It's very safe, obviously. If you're in a cash money market fund at your discount broker, I mean, you really only have two things probably to worry about. One would be that money market fund would go out of business. I'm not going to get into the mechanisms of that. That's probably unlikely. There is some insurance out there and things. Hey, if we got into a 1929 style total economic collapse, could that happen? It probably could, but, I'm probably more likely to have a heart attack or something than that happening. So I really don't worry too much about that. I try and invest with quality brokers, people that have several million dollars or more insurance on each account. So I wouldn't worry too much about the mutual fund going out of business. I think the other thing you'd have to worry about is inflation, and that's always what I hear. People will come up to me and they'll always want to know, John, what are you invested in? And a lot of times I'll say, right now I'm in cash. And they'll look at me kind of dumbfounded and they'll say, they'll think about it for a while, they'll process it. And then usually the first thing out of their mouth is, but you're not getting any interest. And I don't say it quite this way, but always what goes through my mind is, you know, because I'm a little more polite than that, but what always goes through my mind when people ask me those type of investment questions, I immediately think, so what? And you should think that too. So what? So what? So I'm not invested in a 10-year treasury where I have to tie my money up into that for 10 years. I'm only going to get about 2% a year. That's before taxes. With my money in treasuries, I still have an inflation risk. And more importantly, in the very low, artificially manipulated interest rate market that we're in, what would be more concerning to me than inflation is a sudden rise or a rapid rise in interest rates, which would give you interest rate exposure and you'd lose principal on your money that way. So when I'm in cash, pretty much the only thing I have to worry about is maybe inflation. And again, right now that's running at, you know, 2% or less. Well, you know what? I'm not worried about 2% inflation. I wouldn't be worried about 3% or maybe even 4% inflation. Here's why. I'm probably not going to park my money all year long. But even if I did, think of this. We're going into a turbulent year. The market's been up. I think this is the sixth straight year in a row that the market's been up. And I think it's only done that less than three times in the past, maybe only twice before. So what's the odds of it going up again, you know, particularly, you know, having a big run up in the stock market in 2015? Well, they're probably slim, you know, not necessarily none, but they're probably slim. It could very well be a tumultuous market going into next year. And then the year after that, 2016, well, there's a lot going on there. There's presidential elections. Everything will be up for grabs. The Senate, the House, the White House. A lot of states, houses of Congress, many governorships. There could be huge political ramifications just in the United States alone. And that's just the political side, you know, the political equation, which we know is a major pain in our necks. But there's a lot of other things going on. You know, we're seeing these big changes in energy right now. A lot of these oil companies have hedge positions, which will probably get them through 2015, but maybe not into 2016. There's other things going on with the balance sheet on the Federal Reserve and how much of that debt is coming due. And then there's a lot of corporate junk bonds and things that are coming due in 2016, 2017. So these next couple years could be very turbulent. Do I plan to, you know, just sit out the whole market in cash? Probably not. And if I really thought things are that bad, I probably wouldn't be exclusively in cash. I'd maybe go to, you know, a precious metal or something. But I'm just trying to illustrate a point here. Even if I was going to sit out the whole year and I lost 1 or 2 or 3% to inflation, again, I say, so what? Do you have any idea how much the stock market fluctuates on a daily basis? It's huge. Really, at any given week, if you plot out the fluctuation of, you know, just a fairly stable index like the S&P 500, you're going to see that it probably fluctuates, you know, 0.5% to 1.5% every week. And that's just in normal times. During turbulent times, are you kidding me? It's crazy fluctuation. You're worried about 2% inflation over the period of 12 months. Just yesterday alone, on Friday, the S&P 500 lost 1.6%, right? I mean, that's over 1.5%. The Dow Jones Industrial Average, for all of those of you that are, you know, invested in very stable, mature, solid, big capitalization, you know, blue chip stocks, dividend paying stocks, which are all great. I'm not downplaying that at all. I'm just saying those are good, safe places to put your money, right? Those are what they used to call widow and orphan stocks. Well, the Dow Jones Industrial Average yesterday fell almost 1.8%. So you almost lost, you know, roughly round that up to 2%. You lost that yesterday in the Dow Jones Industrial Average, and you're worried about 2% inflation erosion after, oh, you know, over a period of 12 months? Now, don't be ridiculous. Cash is a very safe haven for your money. It's a good port of call. If you're worried about stocks, don't be afraid to move that over into a money mutual fund. So don't ever discount that. Probably spent more time on that than I should have, but so many people don't think about it that I want to just reemphasize that. Cash is an investment option. Keep it in mind. Now, what most people think about it when they think about investing, they think about stocks. So let's talk about stocks for a minute. And really what I want to do is I want to distinguish the difference between stocks and bonds. So a stock is when you're actually an owner in a company. Imagine there's a bakery on the, you know, the corner of where you live, and you go down to the owner and you want to buy a 10% stake in his business. Well, you determine what the market value of his company was. You divide that by 10 and you give him the cash for it. And then you'd have a 10% ownership or stake in that business. Well, whenever you buy a stock like Apple or Google or General Motors, whether you're investing, you know, buying one share for $30 or whether you're buying 10,000 shares for, you know, $300,000. You're an owner in that company at that point. And something you should realize is if that company goes bankrupt, you have absolutely no protection or no real recourse. Oh, you can sue them in things. I don't want to get into that. But just in terms of common law ownership, A lot of times when people, you know, buy a stock, they think they're loaning money to the company, but they're not. A stock means that it's ownership in the company. So just like if you had a 10% ownership in the bakery down the street and that baker goes out of business, you're not entitled to any of the assets or anything that would be sold when that guy has a bankruptcy sale or, you know, a sheriff sale or something. In fact, as an owner, they could potentially come after you because you own 10% in the company. So be cautious of that. Be aware that companies do go bankrupt. Their stocks can, at times, go to absolutely zero and not pay anything. So when you buy a stock, that's the ownership in the company. Now, how is that different from bonds? Now, when you buy a bond, that's a debt instrument. It's also called a debenture. So a bond is a debt instrument. It's an IOU. You can buy a bond from the government. You can buy, for example, a 10-year treasury, and that's where you're loaning the government your money. You're actually giving your money to the government, and they're giving you interest in return and a promise to pay back the principal. The same thing would be if you bought a corporate bond. You could go out on the open market and you could buy bonds in different corporate companies, you know, companies like Apple or Google. In addition to selling stock, right, in addition to having their stock offering, they go out and they raise debt. And that's where they borrow money. And so someone like a Goldman Sachs puts these deals together, and they would have corporate bonds that they would sell in the name of Google, and you would buy that bond, and Google would get your money. And that's an effect where you're actually giving your money to Google for them to spend somehow in their business. It would be a direct exchange with them. They're taking your money. They're going to use it to, you know, somehow increase their profits, build a new factory or something. And what they'll do over time is they'll pay you interest, and they have a promissory note to give you your principal back. Now, that can be in a big corporate bond, or that could be in what we call oftentimes junk bonds. These are high yield bonds. They're bonds that generally are very small companies, in some case micro type companies. The rate of default is very high, and consequently they pay a higher interest rate. So they're called high yield or high value bonds. At the same time, they're junk bonds because oftentimes those companies can go bankrupt, particularly in this turbulent market we're seeing right now. That's one of the concerns, is that we're going to see insolvency and default on a lot of the energy loans from the riskier players. When they go bankrupt, they don't pay back your principal, you don't get your interest, and it becomes junk, and thus the name junk bond. But I do want to point out this difference. Remember when I talked about stocks, if the stock you own goes out of business, then the value of the stock is zero and you have no recourse. Now, if you own a bond, that was actual a loan. It was an IOU. It's like you loaning money to your brother-in-law. He has a responsibility to give it back to you. If he doesn't give it back to you, you can take him to small claims court and file an injunction against him and force the court to make him pay you that money back. But you also know that even though you get that ruling from the court, there's really no enforcement mechanism. If your brother-in-law is broke and he can't pay you back your $500, you're just not going to get it. So although you have legal recourse, it doesn't mean you're going to get it. Well, if you buy a bond, you do have legal recourse to get that money back if the company goes out of business. But as I say, if there's no money there, right, you're not going to get water out of a stone. So stocks, you're buying ownership in the company. You're hoping to get appreciation because you think the future value of that company is going to be worth more than it is today. With bonds, you're loaning money to that company or the government, and you're hoping that they pay you back your principal and also give you the agreed upon interest rate. So the two major asset classes there are bonds and stocks. Now let's talk about mutual funds and exchange traded funds. The stock market, the bond market, these things have been around for centuries. People have always loaned money. Go back and read the Old Testament. You'll see how they talk about loaning money. People have obviously always owned companies. And when they've owned companies, they've sold shares in it. Even if it was just a very simple process where one caveman and another caveman got together and owned a business together. I mean, it was a joint ownership, and they kind of had 50% stock in that caveman company, right? If you go back to the 1400s, when Spain and Portugal and these countries put out major trading ships and fleets, and later on Great Britain did the same thing, as they would trade in the New World, or they'd go to China with their different flotillas, most of those companies were organized by selling stock. No one individual either necessarily had the money or wanted to put all of his money into one ship. Now, sure, the government would, right? The Queen Isabella maybe provides Columbus with three ships so he can go explore the route to China. But that was the government, and that was probably done on debt anyways. As far as an individual, you probably wouldn't go out and put your whole life savings in one ship because it's very risky. If the ship sinks or pirates take it over, you lose all your wealth. So what do? Well, you go out and you find 10 or 100 friends. You put all your money together, and then you have a 10th or maybe 100th interest in that ship. So if it goes out to sea and it never comes back, you didn't lose all your assets. You just lost a 10th of them or 100th. So that was stock ownership. So bonds, lending, IOUs, stocks, they've been around for millennia. What was unique and different was about 60 years ago, they came up with the concept of mutual funds. Now, mutual funds were an amazing thing at the time. And as the name implies, it was a fund. So it was a group of individuals that pulled their money together and then they purchased things. And then it was also mutual, meaning that, there was more than one person involved and it wasn't necessarily a specific company. It was a mutual agreement between investors. And there's different rulings. Again, we're not going to get into those. We're not going to talk so much right now about closed-end funds or open-end funds, just mutual funds in general. Think of it as a way someone organizes a fund. A company comes together, an investment company, they organize a fund. They go out to multiple investors and they say, pull all your money. We'll put all our money into one pool and then we'll manage that money and we'll go out and we'll buy either individual stocks or bonds or both. So this was a great advantage to the individual investor, because if you just had a little bit of money, you couldn't get diversification. So what these mutual funds really did was, not only did they offer convenience and professional management of the money, but they also provided diversification. And remember, diversification means you're diversifying your risk. So again, that's a huge advantage, particularly to the small individual investor. Because if you have a small amount of money, it's very hard for you to split it up into individual company stock. If remember back in the days when Apple was selling at $1,000 a share. Well, if you wanted to buy one share of Apple, you had to have at least $1,000. So you could only own Apple if you had at least $1,000. Now, if you bought Apple through a mutual fund, you could go out and put your $100 investment into this mutual fund, and then mutually you would own a very small fraction of a share of Apple stock through that mutual fund. Okay, so that offered you that diversification. That was a great thing. But you know there's no free lunch, and so to provide you with that diversification and that professional management and all the administrative fees and things, they had to charge fees. And so to manage that fund every year, they may charge 1% or 2% or some variation of it. So if you had $100,000 in there and they were charging you 1% a year, you would be paying that fund $1,000. Now they take it out in very small increments, kind of like tax withholdings. So you never really saw that. If you read the prospectus, you'd understand what it was. Most people never read the prospectus. And so consequently, you may be paying, 2% or more to manage your money through a mutual fund, and you don't realize that. And what's even more insidious than that is that many salesmen obviously latched onto these mutual funds. The industry was happy to do that as well, because they had to market and sell their products. They had to get it out there so people would know about them. So they'd have to pay marketing and salespeople to go out there and promote these funds. And how do you do that? Well, you have to give the salesman an incentive. So he would usually get a commission on these. So in addition to that 1 or 2 or more percent that you're paying for the mutual fund management and administration of the fund, then you're also giving up, 1 or 2 or 3 or 5% to the salesman. And not necessarily, I say the salesman, I mean that generically, like the sales organization. So maybe the individual salesman that sold it to you didn't get that, but Merrill Lynch or, whoever his wirehouse was, they got that. So although mutual funds gave you great diversification, they were a real boon to investors, they also had a lot of expenses and a cost associated with them. Now, since the internet's around and it's easier to keep track of things and more people are sophisticated and aware of these things, the fees have, for the most part, come down. There's not as much of the loaded funds and the higher commissions, although trust me, they're still very much there. And again, a lot of them are buried in administrative funds that you don't see, for example, through your 401k plan, that either you may be paying that you're not aware of, or your employer is paying it through the fees that they have to set up their 401k or 403b or whatever kind of pension plan you're with. So those fees are probably in many cases still there. You're just not aware of them. But now step up to modern times. Mankind is always innovating. They're always making things better. And that's how mutual funds were an improvement for the individual investor over owning just individual stocks or owning individual bonds. Well, the innovation didn't stop there. It took a long time. It mostly was needed to have things like major computer systems and the connectability of the internet. But some very smart people took that mutual fund concept and they turned it into something even better. And that's what's called an exchange-traded fund, ETF. You'll hear many people talk about an ETF and you might not know what it is. Well, again, it's a fund. It's a fund like a mutual fund. But instead of being mutual, where it's a bunch of people that pull their money together, it's traded on an exchange. So it's traded just like a stock in real time. When you own a mutual fund, you have to buy it through the investment company. They only take orders and close out their books, once a day. So generally, at the end of the day, you have a choice to either buy into the fund or sell the fund and cash out of it. Well, that's not the case with exchange-traded funds. You can go to your discount broker, and just like you would instantaneously buy, 100 shares of Apple or Google, well, you can buy 100 shares instantaneously of an exchange-traded fund. And like mutual funds, exchange-traded funds are very diversified. You can buy bonds with them. You can buy stocks with them. You can buy ETFs that invest in both stocks and bonds. You can buy ETFs that invest in emerging markets or only invest in mature economies, or they only buy stocks that are involved in consumer products, or they only buy stocks that are involved in energy-related sector. So you can get as much diversification or as much specialization as you want. And that's what makes them very powerful. You can use them as a source to diversify as well as specify. So for example, like a mutual fund, if you wanted to invest in the S&P 500, the 500 companies that make up the Standard & Poor's Index, you could go out and put your money into a mutual fund that did that. They would take your money, they'd split it up, you wouldn't see it, it's all seamless, you'd be invested in these 500 companies. And then they charge you that management fee we talked about. Well, exchange-traded funds would do the same thing. SPY is an exchange-traded fund. I believe it's the largest in the world. It invests exclusively in the S&P 500, like a mutual fund would. When you put your money into that ETF, your money then gets diversified, and you're an owner in these 500 individual companies. So you get good diversification that way. You'll still receive the dividends and all that. It's all broken up and paid to you proportionally based on your ownership within the exchange-traded fund. But the wonderful thing about it, the thing that's even better than the fact that you can trade these funds instantaneously like a stock, so that way you know exactly what you're paying for, you know what the spread is, and you can track its performance just like you would a stock. What's even better than all that is exchange-traded funds are much more efficient to operate than a mutual fund. And because of that, the cost to you is drastically reduced. So this is one of those examples where the free market is not only providing you with a product that's better, that has, you know, it has more transparency, it's more accessible to you, it's easy for you to purchase. And so that's why I think as an individual investor, particularly if you have a smaller portfolio where you can invest in individual stocks, you're much better off in most cases putting your money into some type of an exchange traded fund. Now, obviously, you have to do your homework. The value of the fund itself is going to come from the underlying investments. So if you buy into an exchange-traded fund that's buying in junk bonds, you can obviously have all the risk of those junk bonds. And if they default, you'll lose all your money. So I'm not saying that categorically exchange-traded funds are perfect. I'm just saying as an investment vehicle, they provide you great diversification. They're very convenient to use, and it's done with very minimal fees. In this podcast, it's hard for me to really verbalize the method that exchange-traded funds use to be so much more cost-effective than mutual funds. But let me just tell you this. It works by a method called arbitrage, and that's the incentive method, where a particular group of authorized participants that are like investment banks that are on the other end of the trades that are being taken place within the exchange-traded fund, these authorized participants are able to take advantage of difference and fluctuations within these various stock trading prices. And so the way the system is set up is they're allowed to buy shares within the exchange traded fund at a low price and then sell the shares of the underlying stock that's within that fund at a higher price, and they make the difference on the spread. Well, what prevents them from making too high of a spread is that there isn't just one authorized participant. Say there's like 100 of them. And so when one makes a trade, the other 99 are trying to make another trade that's advantageous for them. And so it's that incentive, it's that drive of competition, it's that arbitrage between markets where you can make a fraction of a penny, but you're doing it in millions of shares of trade, that someone can come out and make a profit. And then your competitor, your other trading desk that's competing against you, they're going to cut that price down even a little bit more just so they can make more money. So it's these inner workings of these authorized participants that are constantly battling against each other, trying to do what's best for their firms. It lowers that overall spread between the actual value of the exchange-traded fund and the value of the underlying stocks that the fund is invested in. And what that provides the exchange-traded fund with is liquidity and the ability to match buyers and sellers up without them ever providing any infrastructure or without them actually making any trades, so they can do it with virtually no transaction costs. So what it allows them to do is, in effect, they maybe make 10 transactions with their authorized participants, but the authorized participants within themselves, they made 100 million transactions. So the fund benefits from those 100 million transactions, but they only had to support the cost of paying for 10 transactions. It's hard to explain. It's complicated. If you're interested, Google how exchange-traded funds work and arbitration, and you can learn more about it. But the fact of the matter to you is, as an individual investor, there's really no more cost-effective way for you to invest small sums of money to get broad diversification other than going by an exchange-traded fund. So if you're not familiar with them, I'd encourage you to look into that. As I mentioned, I've gotten a lot of questions on these different things. You know, what's the difference between a stock and a bond and an exchange-traded fund? I hope I made that a little more clear for you. If I didn't, as always, please let me know. You can contact me with your questions, your comments, your concerns at our website, which is wealthsteading.com. Now, in our next episode, I'm going to still try and get that out over the weekend. I'm going to answer some listener questions that I received where people wanted to know what was the best stock trading method. So I'm going to tell you the absolutely guaranteed best, in my opinion, stock trading method there is. And like all things, it's not going to be related just to stock trading. This method that I'm going to tell you is something that I think that you can apply in all areas of your life with the analogies that we use to describe it. And there's a little twist associated with it. So until the next episode, this is John Pugliano wishing you the very best of returns.